Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Roderick's with you again. Thanks for joining us. When King Henry II of France suffered a fatal head injury during a jousting tournament in 1559, he left behind Queen Catherine, a 15-year-old heir, and a mistress, Diane de Poitiers. According to our guest today, the lovely Diane lost no time turning cougar on the 15-year-old Prince Henri, first enslaving him with sex, then parlaying her hold over him into real power. This kind of detail pervades the most interesting book on neuroscience you're likely to read this year or any year. Of course, science writer Sam Keen is primarily interested in medical history and the fact that the two most famous doctors of the 16th century got unheard-of permission to autopsy, the king, and find out why a blow that did no serious damage to the front of Henry's skull had ultimately killed him. What they found was that the back of Henry's brain had turned to jelly. The notion that head injuries often affect the opposite side of the brain was a revelation. And according to Sam Keen, the surgeon's desire to peek into the skull got the whole neuroscience ball rolling in a fascinating scientific history called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. Sam Keen argues that scientists have historically learned how the brain works by waiting for something to go wrong with one, thanks to misadventure, war, jousting, disease, or just because crazy things happen. If you want to learn how the brain works and hear some very human stories along the way, put this one on your summer reading list. Sam Keen is one of today's most original science writers. His two previous books, The Disappearing Spoon and The Violinist's Thumb, were bestsellers, and his work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Psychology Today, New Scientist, and Slate. His latest book is called, here it is, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain, as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. It's available from Little Brown. Sam, nice to have you back on the show. Welcome back to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
And I love all the titles of your book, especially this one. And so I'm going to start with the title, if you don't mind. And
sure.
To sort of elaborate on the story I only touched on there about the King of France and these two neurosurgeons. This was really the dawn of neuroscience. But please tell us the story.
Yeah, so this took place back in the 1500s with these two very famous neurosurgeons named Ambrose Paré and Andreas Vesalius. And you usually don't think about neurosurgery going on in the 1500s,
no.
But they were doing these kind of procedures way back then. And so I chose it as the title story because it does show you where neuroscience came from, kind of the start of the field, where a lot of the ideas came from, how it progressed over time. And this was a really interesting case. In fact, one of the most important cases in medical history for a few reasons. First one is that they diagnosed King Henry with what we would now call a concussion, a major concussion. Back then, though, they really didn't believe in concussions. They sort of reasoned about the human head like you would an egg. Whereas if the egg, you know, if you wanted to know whether the yolk inside was damaged, you'd look at the shell and you'd say, well, the shell's not cracked, so the yolk must be fine. They looked at the human head and reasoned the same way, that if there wasn't a gory wound or a big crack in the skull, something like that, then the brain inside must be fine. But Vesalius and Paré were both very experienced, very good doctors, and they knew that that wasn't quite true, that the brain could suffer serious damage without there being obvious external injuries. And so they diagnosed him with a concussion, and they were right that he was going to be very difficult to save, and in fact, he did end up dying. And I like it as a title story, not only because it shows where neuroscience came from, but in a lot of ways, we're still dealing with these same issues today. You hear about, you know, football players who suffer concussions and then go right back out on the field because there's nothing obviously wrong with the outside of their brain. You hear about soldiers who have low-level but pervasive brain damage. They have trouble getting treatment or accepting that they do have the damage because, again, there's nothing obviously wrong from the outside. So in a lot of ways, we're still relearning these same lessons after even 450 years.
What's your understanding about the idea of autopsy generally that early in our human history in the 16th century?
So back then, they did do autopsies sometimes, but usually, actually, they did it to criminals. So they would sentence you to be hanged, and then they would sentence you to be autopsied afterwards. So
it was part of your sentence.
Right. It was kind of a way to wring some more punishment out of you after you died. So it was very rare for them to do an autopsy anyway, and it was especially rare to do it on someone like a king who, you know, wasn't a criminal, obviously. So it was sort of odd that they allowed them to do an autopsy on a king, but science is very grateful that they did because it sort of set a precedent that even normal people could be autopsied. And it was good for the fledgling field of neuroscience because they were able to sort of check their assumptions, confirm that what they had reasoned about the brain was correct, and figure out some things about how the brain works from this case. So again, that's why it was one of the most important medical cases in history.
In the case that we're discussing, King Henry II of France, mm-hmm. he left behind his queen, Catherine de Medici. She's the one that gave permission for the autopsy, right?
She did, and it's a little strange that she did that. She was kind of ruthless, a little power hungry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and ended up kind of precipitating a civil war in France right after this. There's even a story of her when they were still trying to treat King Henry, trying to save him. She wanted the surgeons to try to figure out what exactly to do, come up with a strategy possibly for surgery. So she ordered four criminals basically to be decapitated, and then they were going to use their heads to run experiments on them. So it was kind of this weird mix of medieval brutality, but kind of modern experimental science too, because they were trying to do some experiments with them.
I did make a little digression there in telling our listeners the story of Diane de Poitiers and the heir to the throne. A mere digression from the story of medical history, right?
Right.
But we thought we'd throw it in there for add a little sex to the story.
Never hurts.
Yeah, but Sam, so this idea that direct trauma to one part of the brain could cause damage to another part of the brain, just the opposite part of the brain, right? Mm-hmm. This was new, and this came from this surgery?
Yeah, it's pretty common with concussions where you get hit on one side of the head and the brain damage shows up on the other side of the brain, the opposite side. The reason why is that the brain isn't attached to the skull. So the brain can kind of move semi-independently within the head. So if you imagine getting hit on one side of the head, the skull is moving, the brain doesn't quite move at the same speed. It's a little slow. It needs to catch up. Just like, you know, if you turn your car one direction, suddenly your body feels like it's moving the opposite way. Same thing happens inside the brain. So you get hit on one side, the damage can show up on the other side. So, but again, as you said, that's something they really didn't quite grasp until they started doing and looking at these cases.
Before we go any further, I would like to know just what was the general understanding about brain function in the 16th century? I know that's a big question, but or maybe it wasn't. Maybe there was so little understanding of it, it's easy for you to answer that question. But before these two French surgeons got busy with the king's brain, what was known or what was thought of the brain?
So there were a couple things they did know. Before this, there was actually a very long-running debate about whether thinking got done with the brain or with the heart. Aristotle, for instance, was convinced it was the heart. So a lot of very smart people in history thought the heart did our thinking. It's more centrally located, which makes sense for some sort of commander in the body. It reacts more quickly. You know, if you feel scared or something, your heart starts pounding suddenly, whereas your brain doesn't do much. It just kind of sits there. So it seems like the heart is more involved with day-to-day function. But by this time, they had realized that the brain was the part of the body that does do the thinking. So they knew that. And they were also trying to figure out whether different parts of the brain did different things. Some people said no, that the brain is just sort of one mass like the liver, where it all kind of does the same thing. Other people were starting to say, no, I think there might be different regions in the brain that do slightly different things. So that was kind of a big debate going on.
A debate and really theorizing, right?
Theorizing,
no
yeah.
One really knew for sure.
Right, exactly.
And it wasn't until Paré and Vesalius got into the brain You would say that this is truly the dawn of studying the brain in the, at autopsy stage? Or?
Yeah, it's the start of the way that neuroscience got done for the next probably 450 years and still is getting done today, where you look at a specific injury and you try to figure out what that injury did to the specific part of the brain that got injured and how it changed someone's behavior afterward. And that's really where neuroscience started to take off, when they started taking that approach of figuring out, well, this part is injured, and then the person lost memory, or they lost language, or their emotions got out of whack, something like that. So therefore, this part of the brain that got injured must be involved in language, memory, emotion, whatever it is. That's where you really start to see this approach to studying the brain begin.
What fascinates you about this? Is it because it was the dawn of something, and prior to this, there was a lot of poking around and theorizing about how human beings thought, where thought came from, where emotions came from?
Yeah, I think it fascinates me for it fascinates me for a few reasons, that you do start to see the origins of neuroscience. You start to see people reasoning in a way that we would recognize as pretty modern, pretty scientific. And it's just fun to be sort of at the beginning of this story when it's going on. I also think it's a great story because, you know, it involves a king of France who's about to die. There's a war about to break out.
Right.
You know, there's sex and politics involved. So it's just a good story overall, even without the interesting science.
Before we go to our break here, I want to bring up our first break in this hour with Sam Keen. I want to bring up sort of the local angle, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
This is a fascinating character, and if it takes a little while to explain it, I think it's worth we could pick it up again after the break. But this is the story of Harvey Cushing, a doctor who was an associate of Dr. William Halstead here at Johns Hopkins, right?
Yeah, Cushing was at Johns Hopkins for a while, and he was very interested in sort of brain-body interaction, especially a gland called the pituitary gland, which is really the body's hormone factory. So basically, your brain releases signals that release hormones through the pituitary gland, and then the pituitary gland, releases the hormones that cause you to have sex characteristics, puberty, things like that. All of that stuff comes through the pituitary gland. It was really Cushing, the first one to figure out how the pituitary gland worked and really pursued all of the consequences of that.
He was fascinated with dwarfism. With gigantism, is mm-hmm. that's the word I pronounced it correctly?
Gigantism,
right?
Yep.
Right, and that brought him to the pituitary gland.
Yeah, so the pituitary gland, one of the hormones it releases is growth hormone. And there were all these kind of contradictory studies before that, because some people were saying, well, my patient had a problem with his pituitary gland and he grew up into a giant. And other people were saying, well, I had a patient with trouble with the pituitary gland and she ended up as a dwarf. And so it seemed like it was completely contradictory. How can you have gigantism and dwarfism coming from the same gland? But Cushing was the one who figured out that actually there wasn't a contradiction. It was just the fact that if the pituitary gland has a tumor in it, for instance, its cells start growing out of control, it's going to produce too much growth hormone. You're going to grow up into a giant. Or if you, say, have a cyst that's crushing the pituitary gland, it will kill the cells that produce hormones. You'll have too little growth hormone. You'll end up as a dwarf or a midget. So he was fascinated with dwarfs and midgets. And in fact, he used to travel around from circus to circus, talking with them, you know, taking their medical histories, which was kind of an unusual thing for doctors to do at the time. Most doctors were just interested in treating normal everyday ailments, and they kind of dismissed people who were giants and dwarfs as prodigies, they called them, just inexplicable acts of God, basically. But Cushing realized that there was actually a lot of interesting medical history going on, and he was the one who figured out all of these things about where gigantism and dwarfism comes from.
We're speaking with Sam Keen on Midday. Sam, the author of a really fascinating new book on brain science called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, which takes us on a guided tour of the brain through the stories of victims whose terrible and often bizarre symptoms gave scientists a way to look into our most complex organ and figure out how it works. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back for more with Sam Keen. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with Sam Keen, author of The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. While we may have sophisticated imaging technology today that can tell us a lot more about the brain than we knew before, Sam says that for most of the last four centuries, the only real way scientists could study the brain was to wait for something to go haywire in someone's head. And there are plenty of examples in this informative, highly readable book, a book about neuroscience that's actually very entertaining. So congratulations to you again on this, Sam. Before the break, we were talking about Harvey Cushing of Johns Hopkins University, who studied dwarfism, gigantism, leading him to deeper studies of the pituitary gland. Some of what he did, some of his practices seemed pretty unethical by today's standards.
Right. He definitely would not have gotten away with these things today. The case that really comes to mind is the case of John Turner, who was a giant who was living in Washington, D.C. He was about 7.5 feet tall. And he died one day. Cushing got word of it and actually ordered one of his assistants to go down from Baltimore to Washington, D.C. and harvest the organs out of John Turner's body because Cushing wanted to study them to see what exactly had made him a giant. He ended up giving his assistant $50 to bribe a priest who was taking care of the body at the time. The assistant got there, met the priest, saw John Turner in the casket, and started to give the priest the money.
So there hadn't been a funeral yet.
There had not been a funeral yet, no. The priest took the money, and then the assistant asked if he could help him get the body out of the coffin. And the priest said no, he wasn't going to help him because there wasn't actually permission to do an autopsy. And in fact, the family did not want an autopsy done. But Cushing was a bit ruthless about these kind of things, and he ordered the assistant to do it. So he actually had to end up opening John Turner right there in the coffin and taking his organs out during this, including getting his brain out while the family was gathering in the front parlor.
I'm sorry. I'm having flashes of Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein, even though that was at the end in the lab when the brains were in the jars. Remember, Sam?
Right. Sorry. I mean, it's about that level of it was about that level of what was going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, the priest is trying to run interference, telling the family, like, ignore that sawing noise that you're hearing. You know, you can see the body in a bit. And finally, he got the last gland out, and the dam sort of broke. The family broke into the back room. The assistant took out the back door, grabbed a cab, and basically beat Jakes to the train station so he could get back.
But he got back with not everything that Cushing wanted.
Right.
Cushing was actually a little disappointed in the work, right?
More than disappointed. He was furious because this assistant missed something called the left parathyroid gland, which is sort of an obscure gland in the body.
Where is the left parathyroid?
Exactly. And Cushing erupted at this young man and said, oh, I can't believe you didn't get this. Ended up firing him on the spot after he'd done this. He later got his job back, but this was Cushing. He was volatile. He was a bit ruthless, but he was a pretty fantastic scientist in the end.
Yes, amazing researcher, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he got away with a lot, it seems, from my reading of the book, that because of Halsted. And we had another medical historian on the show once talking about William Stewart Halsted at Hopkins and his addiction to cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
So he spent his afternoons in his house in Mount Vernon in Baltimore. So I guess Cushing felt he had liberty to pursue things maybe that Halsted wasn't aware of.
Yeah, so Cushing basically was unsupervised and could do whatever he wanted. You know, some of us might take advantage of that to go to the beach or something like that, but Cushing basically decided he was going to spend all his time doing experiments things. So he was one of the first people to use x-rays, for instance, to try to find tumors within the skull, things like that. So he really did a lot with medical technology. He was also very, very big on photography very early on and documenting the progression of cases, things like that. So very, very innovative doctor. And part of the reason he was able to do these things was basically no one was telling him not to, as they might have been had he not had the supervisor.
But what we would regard as unethical, or maybe even back in that day considered unethical based on the story you just told, also shows this desire and eagerness to learn to do the research.
Oh, definitely. Right. It was all in the sense, or all in the service of pursuing knowledge, trying to help other people in the future. So we do blanch at it, but he was doing it for a higher calling to try to help people.
Now, speaking of unethical experimentation or research, my associate producer, Michael Himowitz, wanted me to ask you if the work of Dr. Robert Bartholow, might not have been the most unethical experiment in history.
Yeah, this was one of those experiments that was a little tough to read and write about and do research about. Basically, this was the time when people were really starting to figure out that the brain did have separate regions that controlled separate functions in the brain. So there might be a spot that's very involved with language or memory, things like that. They had done some work with human beings on this, but mostly they'd been looking at animals. They would stimulate part of their brain, see if they made a noise or if they moved their legs, something like that. Bartholow's case was really one of the first to look at a human being. He had a maid come in. Her name was Mary Rafferty, who had, unfortunately, an ulcer in her scalp that ended up opening up her scalp, disintegrating it. And basically, you could see her brain on the inside. You could just look and see her brain through the top of her head. And she was kind of a goner by that point. She'd waited too long to get treatment, and there was probably nothing they could do anyway. So they spent basically their time, you know, changing her dressings, trying to comfort her, trying to make her feel better. But Bartholow got this idea that it would be really interesting to test and see if he could figure out if we had specialized function in the brain, because he could see her brain right there. He was also very interested and involved with electricity, using electricity to treat medical ailments. So he decided he was going to try to spark her brain in different spots, see if he could get her to do things. And unfortunately, he used too much electricity. She was sort of kicking her legs out. She was screaming at different points. And he just kept going with this experiment. So again, it's a very, very difficult experiment to read about. And it does show you the contrast between, you know, what happened back then and what's going on nowadays, where we have, you know, institutional review boards, things like that, that would prevent these kind of things from happening. So it is a good lesson, I think, to read about these kind of cases.
Is there a contribution to science from that story and the takeaway?
There is some in that he did end up proving that we do have specialized regions in the brain, because he would move the electrodes around from different places, from place to place within her brain, and sometimes she would make a noise. Sometimes she would kick a leg, sometimes an arm, something like that. So he did end up confirming what he wanted to confirm, even if the cost was pretty high.
We're speaking with Sam Kane. His latest book is The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons: The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. At the outset of the show, I mentioned Franz Liszt, the famous composer, great composer, who used to speak about music in terms of color.
Mm-hmm.
He actually heard music as colors and would refer to members of the orchestra, would refer to colors, telling them, I need that to be bluer, I need that to be more purple, mm-hmm. or that this part of the composition is supposed to be rosé, not pink, things like that.
Right.
What was going on there, and why did you include that story in the book?
So he had a condition called synesthesia, which is basically when two senses in your brain kind of fuse together in this trippy, interesting way. So you hear a tone like he did, and you would see a color flash before your eyes. Other people, when they see numerals, like a numeral 5, 7, something like that, they actually see them in different colors as well. So again, it's when two senses blend together in your mind. So a sight will provoke a color, or a tone, something that you hear will provoke a color.
So I'm not just imagining this. I'm actually
seeing it. You
right?
are actually seeing it. It's not just something kind of going on in your head. You're actually seeing, experiencing this. And it's not that uncommon. It's not unheard of. And actually, from what I've heard, I don't have this condition, and I don't know anyone that does. But from what I've heard, people who have it actually kind of feel sorry for the rest of us, because they live in this really rich and interesting, unusual world. And it would be like us just having no color vision or something. They say, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I can't imagine what life must be like. It must be so drab for all of the rest of you.
But we do see things in color. But we don't hear things in color.
Right. We don't hear in color. We don't get the blend of
things. We don't have this fusion or blend of senses, right?
Right.
That condition is called, again, synesthesia?
Synesthesia, yes.
Does it happen with other senses, like smell and color?
It can. Actually, any two of your senses can blend together in this way. There's some very entertaining stories in the book about people who have touch-taste synesthesia. So they feel, say, a wrought iron fence, and they'll get a salty taste in their mouth, something like that. Or there was a man who was cooking chicken for a dinner party, and he kept complaining that the chicken was coming out too spherical. He wanted his chicken to be pointier, and he just kept explaining this, and obviously no one had any idea what he was talking about.
It's hard to get your head wrapped around
right,
that.
Right, but that was how it really felt to him.
How do we know... Boy, this is a tough question. I mean, how do we know clinically that such a condition exists, aside from the fact that people tell us or tell doctors and researchers that that's what they're experiencing?
Right. It is a very good question. You know, it could be like how we talk about a loud shirt or sharp cheddar cheese. It could be a metaphor.
Yeah.
They actually can do tests where these people's brain work a little differently. One of the tests involves, if you think about an alarm clock, think about the two on an alarm clock, kind of this blocky shape with just line segments. If you think about that, and then think about what a five looks like on an alarm clock. They're kind of opposites. One is flipped back and forth. Mm-hmm. So one test you can do with people is you can give them a sheet of paper that has a bunch of these alarm clock twos on it. But every once in a while, you sprinkle in a five. And they're kind of on the page in this random order, just kind of wherever you want to put them. Mostly twos, but a five every now and then. If you ask a normal person, point where the fives are. Most of us have a lot of trouble. We have to go one by one and look at this because the shapes are so similar.
Similar, yeah.
People with synesthesia can go, it's there, 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 and there because they show up in a different color. So it pops out with them immediately, and they're consistently much better than the rest of us. So that's an example of a test where it really does show that their brains are working differently.
You also mentioned in your book some other famous figures, and one of them is President Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson had perfect vision, but couldn't see anyone or anything on his left side.
Right. So he suffered a stroke fairly late in his administration. And as you said, it didn't affect his vision, but what it did affect is his ability to pay attention to things. So if you introduced someone on his right side, it would be perfectly normal. He would say hello, shake their hand, or whatever. If a person approached on his left side, he would not notice them. He just could not focus his attention and notice the person. If you explicitly pointed out that the person was there, he could see the person. But something about his conscious mind just couldn't grasp that the person was there.
Couldn't sense the presence.
Right.
But his vision was fine.
It wasn't a problem with vision.
It wasn't a problem with peripheral vision.
It was the ability to not pay attention to something. That is what he
on
had
that
lost.
Side.
Just on half of his half of his brain, on half of his world. And it's a little hard to wrap your head around. Like, how could this possibly be? But it is a symptom you see. It's not a common symptom, but you do see it in lots and lots of patients. Mm-hmm. It's called hemispatial neglect, where basically half your world, you just neglect it. You don't notice it.
Well, that's like Rush Limbaugh. He doesn't even notice people on the left, right?
Right.
Okay. So President Wilson lived out his days this way? Did it interfere with his administration?
He ended up recovering somewhat. He got a little better, but he never really did get quite back to the state he was in before. And he had some other problems after these strokes as well. He was having some emotional difficulties, things like that. And especially right after his stroke, he was basically incapacitated. And his wife and one of his close advisors ended up basically running the country for him without the knowledge of even his cabinet or his vice president. They sort of secluded him, wouldn't let anyone see him, and were kind of running the country behind the scenes.
Sam, we're going to take another break here, and we'll come back and talk some more with Sam Keen, our guest in this hour of midday. The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons. More stories to tell, more ground to cover here. Boy, there's a lot in this book we haven't gotten to. The history of the human brain as revealed by the true stories of trauma, madness, and recovery. Dan Roderick's here on Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks with Sam Keane, author of this really fascinating book on brain science called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, which takes us on a guided tour of the brain through the stories of victims whose terrible and often bizarre symptoms gave scientists a way to look into our most complex organ and figure out how it works and sometimes how to fix it when things go wrong. The true stories of patients and their doctors, stories of trauma, madness, and recovery. And they run the gamut from heartbreaking to inspiring to darkly amusing, but great reading. So, Sam, thanks again for being with us today. We talked about President Woodrow Wilson, and his problem after a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to go back to something you touched on earlier about left brain, right brain, or in President Wilson's case, he couldn't sense the presence of anyone approaching him on the left,
right,
even though his vision was fine. That got me thinking about left brain, right brain,
mm-hmm.
split brain.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about neuroscience with regard to understanding left brain, right brain functions and the different functions of the brain?
Yeah, so left brain, right brain is something most people have probably heard of.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, you can kind of blow it out of proportion in some cases. You know, it's not like the left brain only is involved in logical things and the right brain's only involved with artistic things. But there is some truth to that idea that they do have specialized functions. And a lot of this came from some studies on what are called split brain people. So basically what they did is there were the people, some people having severe epilepsy. They couldn't control it with drugs or anything like that. So what they decided to do was they decided to perform surgery on them. And they ended up cutting a part of the brain called the corpus callosum, which is a bundle of nerve fibers that connects the right and left hemisphere. It's basically the way the right and left hemisphere communicate with each other is through this corpus callosum. So they ended up cutting that in half in these patients, and they don't quite know exactly why, but it ended up being a very good cure for epilepsy. It really helped them out. So it was a real boon to them, a real boon to their lives. But it did end up causing some kind of quirky traits to emerge in these people when they did some psychological testing on them afterward. Mostly they were fine. Their memory was okay. They could still speak, walk, things like that. But every so often they would notice them doing something unusual. For instance, these people, if you gave them, you know, two pencils and asked them to draw two figures, they could take one pencil in their right hand and their left hand. They could draw completely independent figures with their right and left hand, which if you try it at home is mind-bendingly hard. It is really, really hard to do, say, a triangle with one hand and a square with the other hand.
Yeah, I don't think I could do that.
Yeah, I bet.
You've tried it?
Yeah. I have tried it. I was terrible. I'm not good anyway with just one hand, but two hands, it was a disaster.
Right.
There were other things they could do as well, or I should say tests that they would fail. For instance, there were these certain screens where they would flash a word like hot dog. And they would flash it so that the word hot was going into one eye and the word dog was going into the other eye. And then they would ask people afterward to draw a picture. And when they did this test to normal people, they would, of course, draw a hot dog, you know, with the bun, mustard, all that kind of stuff. When they did this same test to the split brain people, they would take a pencil in each hand again, and one hand would draw a dog, and the other hand would draw a sun or something like that, because they couldn't get the words together in their mind. Mm-hmm. So basically, again, their two halves of their brain were working completely independently. And from these kind of studies is where they really figured out that the left and right brain have distinct and unusual talents.
How about what you call the Siamese brain? This is another interesting story from Sam Keane's book, a story about conjoined twins, I think Canadian twins.
Canadian, yep.
Tatiana and Krista, yes, Canadian twins, born in 2006.
So, yeah, they're still alive today, and they're a really good example of why these stories are still important today, and they're still teaching us things today. So they're conjoined twins, what used to be called Siamese twins, and they're joined at the head. So their brains are basically connected. More specifically, a part of the brain called the thalamus is connected. Thalamus is very involved with sensory information. So information from your eyes, your taste buds, your ear, all of that goes into the thalamus first, and it's kind of a relay and processing center. So it takes sensory information in and then sends it to different parts of the brain for processing. Because they share a thalamus, these two little girls, mm-hmm. they actually share sensory information, which means, for instance, if one girl is taking a sip on a cup of juice, the other girl can actually taste the juice in her mouth. Or if you tickle one of the girls, the other one will start laughing. Or if you give one a shot at the doctor's office, the other one winces in pain. Actually, my favorite story involving this was, you know, they're little kids. They were at a fast food restaurant once, and they got into a fight about something. So they're siblings. They start pushing each other, calling each other names. Finally, one of the girls got sick of it, reached out and slapped her sister in the face, and then immediately grabbed her own face in pain because it hurt her. So maybe a good lesson for kids to learn there.
Sam.
But you see this really incredible behavior, and they're really starting to teach scientists some interesting things about the fact that you can kind of share your consciousness like this with another person.
How about this? So help me with a myth or an understanding. There are stories that I've heard over the years about Einstein's brain. Mm-hmm. The genius Albert Einstein had a bigger brain than normal, or that he used parts of his brain that normal people, average people, don't use. What have you found out about that? And could that possibly be true, or is that just a simplistic and sort of mythical idea?
So I did write about Albert Einstein's brain a little bit in my second book called Violinist Thumb. And it's actually the opposite, that Albert Einstein actually had one of the smallest brains that they had ever seen, the doctor who took it out. It was very, very small, kind of on the low end of normal. He made the face you're making right now, which is, wow, I can't believe that. It's incredible to think about, but he had a
Because I've heard exactly the opposite for forever.
No, if you look at the autopsy records, he had a very, very small brain. And they have done studies on it, tests over it over the years to, you know, try to figure out whether he had maybe some unusual folds or a higher density of neurons, things like that. And they have found some things that looked a little unusual, but definitely no smoking guns. And even when you're looking at the things that might be unusual, it's very hard to tell when you have a sample size of one. So they know that Einstein was very smart, obviously, but was this just something unusual about his brain that no one else had? Or was this something that really contributed to him being a genius? For instance, there are parts of his brain in the parietal lobe, which is kind of on the pate, on the top of your head, that seem to be bigger in Einstein. They also seem to be bigger in people who play music for a living. Einstein took violin lessons from the age of six, played it his whole life. So is it the music lessons that did it, or is it, you know, something to do with his genius? Very hard to kind of tease these things apart.
Another figure from your present book, the Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, is James Holman, right? Mm-hmm. I have the name correctly. He was an explorer.
He was.
He was blind.
Yes. So he was in the British Navy. He came down with a disease. Then he lost all sight in his eyes. So he was completely blind. But he did not let that stop him. And he actually became the most prolific traveler that the world had ever seen up to that time. He ended up traveling 250,000 miles. This was in the early 1800s, which is basically the equivalent of going to the moon. I mean, that's a long way to travel back then.
The old-fashioned way. Yeah.
The old-fashioned way. And it's not like he was just passively being led around from place to place. He was going on ships that were hunting down slave traders. He climbed Mount Vesuvius in mid-eruption. He was doing some pretty adventurous things. The way he got around, despite his blindness, was he had a cane, and he would take the cane and he would strike it on the ground. And the cane had a metal tip on it, so it would create sound waves. Sound waves would bounce off things in front of him and create an echo. Then he would listen for the echo, and based on the echoes, he could kind of triangulate what was in front of him, whether there was a horse there or a doorway, something like that.
Stop for a minute. Imagine yourself doing this.
Right.
Say you're standing on the driveway of your house, and mm-hmm. you're near your garage. You're within 6 or 7 feet of the garage, and you have such a thing, a mm-hmm. staff with a metal tip, you said, mm-hmm. and you tap it on the driveway, on the blacktop, the asphalt. I don't know what that would do for me. Would I be able to sense how far away the garage door was?
You would over time. It's not something he learned how to do instantly or that his brain knew how to do immediately. The important thing especially is the contrast. So you might be able to tell whether the door was open or closed. You might be able to tell whether your garage was empty or whether there was a car there. Mm-hmm. You might be able to say, okay, it looks like my garage extends for a few feet to my left, but then it stops and then there's a hedge there, something like that.
Couldn't I do that with my voice?
You could do it with your voice.
You can tell if a room is empty or not.
Exactly, you can.
But with your own voice. You step into the door and, you know.
Right, and there actually are people today who make these sort of clicks with their tongue who can do the exact same thing that you're talking about. So people can do this. I think the advantage of a metal cane was that it made nice, sharp, short clicking noises. And for whatever reason, that's kind of what he preferred, what he got used to. But you're right, you could do it with your voice, and people do it today.
That's how Holman got around.
Yep, by doing it.
And it became known as echolocation.
Echolocation. It's basically the same thing that bats use or that dolphins use. He basically retrained his brain. Because if you look at the people today who do it with their voice or the people alive who do it with a cane or something, and you scan their brain, look at what's going on, you actually start to see a lot of activity in the visual parts of their brain. So that part of the brain, because they're blind, has been sitting idle, not doing anything. But the brain can retrain itself. The brain is a plastic organ, can change what it's doing. And that information, even though it's coming in through your ears, ends up getting processed in the visual parts of your brain. So Holman basically retrained his brain to navigate in a completely different way.
Sam Keen, I want to ask you about Capgras syndrome, mm-hmm. C-A-P-G-R-A-S, pronounced Capgras, named after a French scientist?
French doctor, yep.
French doctor. And this sounds like we get into the area of delusion with this, no? Mm-hmm.
So Capgras syndrome is basically the belief that all of your loved ones have been replaced by imposters, imposters. So someone kidnapped your wife or your child, replaced them with an actor or an android or a clone or whatever that looks exactly the same, has the same memories, but it's not the same person.
It sounds like paranoid delusion.
It does sound like paranoid delusion. It sounds like something that would be purely psychological. But actually, it involves damage to specific regions in the brain. And it's not a common condition, but people who have damage in these parts very often come down with these exact same syndromes. They always believe that their loved ones have been replaced by imposters, and there's some sort of conspiracy going on to hide this fact from them. It's very unusual, but it's a reproducible symptom from organic brain damage.
Did you know anything about this before you worked on the book?
No. This was one of the things
that's extraordinary to me.
Right.
Because it sounds like something out of science fiction, mm-hmm. right? That I think my wife is actually an alien.
Mm-hmm.
But even though it doesn't affect much of the population, small group of people.
Very small.
They all have the same story,
yeah,
or a similar
exactly
story.
There were several stories like this that I actually, when I was kind of hunting around for a topic for this book, I read about them and I just said, no way. I said, that's baloney. That cannot be true. And basically the book came about because I tried to kind of disprove a bunch of these stories and found out that not only they were true, but they reveal something about how the brain works.
Sorry, I'm channeling another movie. It's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm. Richard Dreyfuss and several other people all see Devil's Tower. They keep having the same image in their brain of Devil's Tower. They don't know what it is, but they know they end up figuring out that it's Devil's Tower, right? In Arizona, wherever it is, Wyoming. And they go there. So what explains this, Sam Keen? I worry about giving away too much from your book, but there's so much in this book. I'm actually not worrying about it anymore.
There, yeah.
But a little bit more on Capgras. What explains that?
So basically it involves a disconnect between the parts of your brain that recognize faces and the parts of your brain that the parts of your brain that process emotions. So most of us, when we see someone that we like, a loved one, we recognize the person and we also get a little bit of a kick. It's called a glow. You kind of feel good that you're around this person. Right. Or, you know, sometimes you see someone you don't like and you get a sort of the opposite glow. You don't mm-hmm. like the emotion. But regardless, you have an emotion of some sort. What happens in Capgras syndrome is that there's a disconnect between those two systems in the brain. So they can recognize the person. They know it looks exactly like that person, but they don't get any sort of kick. They don't feel that glow, that emotional warmth. In fact, they feel a deadness inside them when they see this person. So they become convinced that it's not really that person. It looks like them. They know on a rational level it looks like them, but deep down, emotionally, it doesn't feel like that person. And emotions are very, very powerful, very strong. And if you can imagine, if you just suddenly had a disconnect with a loved one like that, you would really feel empty inside. And so they kind of jump to this, what sounds like to us, a crazy conclusion, but it's the only way they can really explain this feeling that they're having inside.
So does that mean that in neuroscience, then, there is a school that believes that emotional problems are conditions such as depression, even schizophrenia, are all connected in some way to a physical problem in the brain?
Yeah, we do know that symptoms like that, there has to be something at some level going on in the brain. So maybe it's not, you know, damage anatomically that you could find. It might be chemical imbalance of some sort, something like that. So most neuroscientists nowadays are pretty comfortable with the idea that our minds are based in the brain and that everything that arises in the mind has some sort of correlation to something going on in the brain. We're not to the point where we could, you know, just look and say, aha, this is exactly what's going on. But we're making progress along those lines.
Sam, what was the biggest aha or wow moment for you in doing the research in the on this book? Was it the Siamese brain or was it Capgras syndrome?
The Siamese brain is pretty amazing.
It is.
I think that's the one that really stands out, where every time I hear that, I just get a little goosebump, even though I know exactly what's going to happen. It's just incredible to think about that.
Sam Keen has been our guest in this hour of Midday on WYPR. Back with us again after the first time we met Sam was his book, The Disappearing Spoon.
Yep.
First time. We didn't get you in here for The Violinist's Thumb, his second book. But now this book, recommended for summer reading, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Little Brown is the publisher. Sam, it's great to have you on our show again. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everybody. That's the first hour of Midday. Stay tuned for a second hour coming up after the news from NPR.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.